Peter King here, reminding you to subscribe and listen to all new and archived episodes of the MMQB podcast with Peter King, as well as the MMQB podcast with Albert Breer and the 10 Things MMQB podcast.
Sports Illustrated presents the Media Podcast with Richard Deitch, powered by digital media. Find your voice. Now, your host, Richard Deitch.
Welcome to the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast, where each week we interview a member of the sports media. I'm your host, Richard Deitch, and today our guest is the ESPN, NBA, and college basketball analyst, Doris Burke, one of the best practitioners of the craft, and really excited to get into a long, in-depth conversation with her about how she approaches what she does, the role of women in sports broadcasting, and some specific topics, including how to interview Greg Popovich, which can be very tricky. So Doris Burke is the guest this week, and I think you're going to enjoy it. Here's Doris. Okay, and as promised, we bring in the pride of Providence College, ESPN's Doris Burke. Doris, welcome to the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast.
Thank you, Richard. I have listened to a number of these, so I'm excited that you finally asked, my friend.
Yes. Doris, we know each other a long time,
mm-hmm.
at least over a decade now. And one of the things that is interesting to me about your broadcasting journey was that I think there's a lot of young people now who see you. They see you on either NBA studio shows or as an NBA analyst, seeing you doing women's games. They have no idea that there was once upon a time you were really grinding at sort of the beginning of a broadcast career, very far away from ESPN. And so I wonder now if you head back to even like 2003 when you were doing games for Madison Square Garden Cable, is this where you imagined you would be, or has your career been somewhat of a surprise to you?
No, my career has absolutely been a complete happy surprise, almost you could say a happy accident, to be perfectly frank with you. You know, I thought I would be a high school teacher and coach, and I broadcasting, truth be told, and I would not, you know, given how competitive the landscape is, to try to break in now is drastically different than how I broke in. So I, you know, left college. I was a counselor at a private school initially, and the coach I played for at Providence invited me back, wanted me to be on his staff. I took that job for 2 years. And in that 2 years, Richard, I got engaged, and I knew I wanted to get married. I knew I wanted to have children, and I knew that there were successful women who had done it. You know, Pat Summitt certainly comes to mind. But when I was an assistant at Providence, my days pretty much started at 7 with individual workouts and probably ended somewhere around 9 or 9:30 with recruiting calls. And, you know, with a terrific husband, you could probably make that work. But that was not the life I wanted to lead. And so I ended up leaving coaching. And the year I left, they put Providence College women's basketball on radio, maybe 10 to 12 games. That was 1990.
Wow.
And I kid you not, it is and has been from that year sort of this period of just, you know, incremental steps. And it's funny you say people look at me now and they think that, you know, this is where I have been. On Saturday, I'll do a little bit of, I don't know if you'd call it mentoring. I'm going to be on a panel with two other women broadcasters, sort of addressing some Big East student athletes. And, you know, one of the things I want to tell them is don't ever turn your nose up at whatever you might consider to be the most humble of beginnings. Because there were times on that Providence College women's broadcast that my partner wouldn't show up. And I would call a women's basketball game over a telephone line by myself and essentially do play-by-play in color, none of which I had formal training to do. And it's been a long time and a steady journey, and I have been incredibly lucky. Few really, you know, fortuitous bounces along the way. And, you know, here I am at this point and just get this new assignment from ESPN calling a package of NBA games.
Well, I did not know, by the way, that you you served as both play-by-play and color for games at Providence College. That is not easy. What is there a moment in your career, and maybe it was getting the call from ESPN, but is there a moment in your career where you consider the big break or consider the sort of the demarcation line for you where your career really shifted from one place to another place?
I would say there have been sort of several seminal moments. And the first would have been, and I don't remember the year exactly, it could have been 94, 95, somewhere in that vicinity. But again, don't hold me to it. I am getting older now. But Mike Gorman, you know, the current voice of the Boston Celtics, had heard me on radio and said, you know, I think you have potential in this. I would like to help you. And at that point, I was calling some Big East women's basketball, which was at its very beginning when the Big East still had its own television network. And as you know, many conferences did at that point. And, you know, in a little twist of fate, Mike was supposed to call a noon game, Pittsburgh at Providence College, Saturday at noon. And it would have been the game of the week on ESPN regional television. You know, something that's now out of our vernacular, ESPN regional. But he didn't show, and it was miscommunication. He had made it clear he couldn't. Ronnie Perry was supposed to have been his analyst. I had spent the morning at my house at the hospital with my son, Matthew, who had fallen off a weight bench in my basement, with my then husband and my daughter, and he needed several stitches. And when we got back home, my husband, then husband, who was the associate athletics director, had about 15 messages. Is Doris there? Can she call the noon game? So this is probably 11 a.m. for a 12 o'clock tip. And, you know, I had not studied, prepared. And Greg said, what do you think? I said, please ask Ronnie to slide to play-by-play because he has an established reputation. I don't know how to do the play-by-play, and if I open myself up to that, I'll get exposed. Please see if he's willing to slide over. And he did. And because, Richard, I was an enormous basketball fan and would have watched that game, probably attended it anyway, you know, I knew the players, and basketball has just been second nature to me because I've been playing, coaching, or covering it since I was 7 years old. And I did a good enough job. And the very next year, I got a small package of men's games on ESPN Regional. So that I would point to as one. Another I would point to is the formation of the WNBA in 1997. And again, Mike Gorman steps in and says, you need to be a part of this. And that first year, I only got the New York Liberty radio package. The second year, I got the Liberty television package. And at that moment, Mike McCarthy, who has been president of the network, said, we really believe in your skills. If Clyde ever needs a replacement, which is rare, we would like you to do it. That would be another one. And then the final one that I always point to, Bob Stites, who longtime either conference or college administrator, obviously his dad was the guy who put the three-point line into college basketball, was, you know, a big push to get that into the college game. Bob Stites, it was the Atlantic 10 Network's associate commissioner, and his color analyst was leaving, and he called Mike Breen and said, Mike, here are the three people I'm considering, and I was on the list. And Mike Breen said, well, he said, if you want my honest answer, Doris is the best of the three, but I'm not sure you're prepared to take that to your coaches or answer to your administrators. And Bob Stites, and this is, I believe, 1998. Think about that, Richard. Think about Bob Stites having the willingness at that point to make me an analyst on the Atlantic 10 men's package. You know, that took some guts. Mm. And he told me a funny story. And forgive me, I'm so long-winded here. He told me a funny story, Richard, the second year. So the second year, first game, we're sitting out to dinner. And I said to him at dinner, I said, you know, could you please tell me the reaction of your coaches when you told them I was going to be the primary analyst? Because, as you know, even back then, the Atlantic 10 was fighting for respectability amongst major conferences. And he said, do you really want to know that? I said, I do. And he said, well, I'm not going to exactly tell you. But he said, I'll tell you what my response to them was when any of them voiced an objection. My response to them was, listen to her. Let her get through the season. And if at the end of the season you have an objection, then I will revisit it with you. And I'm about a third of the way through the season. And then Temple coach John Chaney calls Bob and says something along the lines of, that girl you got, she's okay. Mm-hmm. And so that was the blessing I got from John Chaney. So there's been several moments, and forgive me for that long-winded answer, but, you know, there's people you're indebted to who've helped you along the way, and certainly, you know, that's some of how some things have transpired.
Yeah, no. First of all, no apologies. It's a podcast, so we have all day. And secondly,
I also heard I could curse on the podcast, which my friends are going, that's a dangerous proposition because you swear like a pirate.
That's interesting, Doris, because we never have heard you curse on air, and I think people think of you as incredibly professional, not someone who's dropping, you know, let's be blunt, motherfuckers and other things. So I actually would almost encourage you.
The golf course.
Yeah, I would encourage you at least at one point in this podcast, feel free to curse if you must. What was interesting about your story, Doris, is that obviously Mike Gorman played a significant role in your career, but all the people who really stepped up for you were men, and it had to be men because the business, mm-hmm. as you know better than most people, has long been controlled by men. Men make the assignments to place people in men's sports, and so I don't know how else to phrase it, but it took some guts for some of these men to step out of whatever the conventional wisdom was and to put a woman in positions that prior to you had never been held by a woman.
You know, Beth Mullins last year, Sean McDonough won it this year, the Marty Glickman Award, which is, you know, for the great Syracuse broadcast journalism program, is arguably the highest honor you can get. And Beth Mullins won it the year before Sean. And, one of the things Beth said when it was her turn to speak, and she obviously was the last person of the evening, was essentially that the only way hiring decisions, and then beyond that, acceptance from the sports fan is going to happen is exactly the way you say it's going to happen. Those in the hiring positions have got to be willing to, one, take the chance. Obviously, you want to make that an educated chance. You want to have somebody whose work habits are good and who has proven, perhaps at lower levels, that they're capable of handling the job. There is a process to sort of advancing in any job, right? We all pay our dues. We all have stories to tell and things to share. But as with any change, sometimes the reactions are not always positive, and it takes some time. And one thing I would say is, and I've said this before, what's been amazing to me and what has always encouraged me has been that while there's definitely been some people who don't like my style or my voice or whatever the case may be, it is a very subjective deal that we're a part of. The soft landing spot for me has always been the players and the coaches, because, if they had objections early on, they did not make me aware of them. And I've always just been accepted as a basketball person. And so have there been tough moments for me? Sure there have. But when I walk into a gym and I can feel, because respect is mutual, when you can feel that someone thinks, okay, you know, she's working hard, she's credible, she understands, she calls a good game, we keep it moving at that point.
It's interesting. You know the expression, game recognizes game. And a lot of times I think that is one thing that's been an equalizer in broadcasting. And having covered the women's game, I see this a lot. There will always be male coaches and I think male sports fans who will give the benefit of the doubt to women who either played, you know, Rebecca Lobo, et cetera, or who coached, people like you, Doris Burke. So that's an interesting observation.
This is the Media Podcast with Richard Deitch.
All right, everyone knows shaving is a pain. Let's just be blunt. Whether you're a man or a woman, you can't find the perfect razor. If you do find a razor, oftentimes you end up cutting yourself, you nick yourself up. It's never a enjoyable experience, to be blunt. But you can now stop compromising on your shave and get started with Harry's. For far too long, you've probably paid too much money for a comfortable shave, or as I said at the top, you've basically settled for a low-quality razor, which is on sale at the bargain bin. But Harry's offers something you've never had before, a great shave at a fair price. Harry makes its own high-quality razors, it cuts out the middleman, and ships them directly to you for half the price of a leading brand. A good shave, a great price. It's simple. Get the best of both with Harry's. I can speak from personal experience. I've shaved this week with Harry's. It's basically the best shave I've gotten in a long time. Blades are sharp. Finally, I'm not bleeding. Thank you very much, Harry's. And it basically provides a close, comfortable shave. On top of that, the moisturizing shave cream smells amazing. And who doesn't like to smell amazing? What makes Harry's unique? Again, it's just one razor, five German-crafted blades, flex-hinged, and a lubricating strip, quality guaranteed, and they give you a full refund if you are not happy. Again, this is factory direct prices. You cut out the middleman, no upcharges, half the price of the leading brand. Now, Harry's starter set is called the Truman, great president as well. It's a great option for new customers and an amazing deal. For just $15, you get a razor handle, moisturizing shave cream, and three of Harry's five-blade German-engineered razors. Plus, there is a special offer for fans of this podcast. Harry's will give you $5 off your first purchase using the promo code MEDIA, M-E-D-I-A. What do? You go to harrys.com right now and look for the Truman set. That's harrys.com, H-A-R-R-Y-S.com. Enter code MEDIA, M-E-D-I-A, at checkout to get $5 off. And you also are helping support the show. Stop compromising and give Harry's a try today. Doris, one of the things that I really like about this podcast is that there are a lot of students who listen to it, both broadcast and digital print, and both, I think, a pretty fair share of both young men and young women. For at least anecdotally, I feel like it's broken down pretty good along gender lines. And one of the questions I got when I put out there that you were going to be on the podcast was people wanted to know how you prepared for a broadcast. But this is what was interesting about you. It wasn't just a general preparation question. People wanted to know how you prepared for each of the different roles that you have. So if you would, I want to go through each of them, starting with how would you prepare for a game in which you'll be, an NBA game where you will be a sideline reporter?
Well, I mean, every morning I get one email, under cover of which is every article from across the NBA. And so the first portion of my day is spent several hours just reading articles from across the league. And that helps me regardless of whether I'm the analyst, the host, or the sideline reporter of the NBA. So, you know, essentially I cover three different sports. It's the same sport, but it's men, women, and college. And so, you know, to the greatest degree your schedule allows, you immerse yourself into the milieu of each of those three respective sports. And there's several ways I think a broadcaster's job has become an awful lot easier. One, ESPN has obviously an extraordinary research department. You know, these are people that are behind the scenes, but as you said, you know, announcers can grind. It can be a grinding schedule. I remember early in my career one time calling 9 games in 7 days, all in 7 different cities. Wow. And so, you know, the fact that now somebody might be able to put every article from across the NBA under cover of one email is a big deal. So for the sideline, you know, my job, at least as I interpret it via ESPN, is in some respects to connect the audience to these athletes personally. You know, is there something interesting about their journey? And it took to be, I believe being a sideline reporter has helped me be an analyst, and here's why. I don't necessarily think when I started in the business I was interested in anything other than X's and O's and, you know, the basketball aspect. And the first time I did sideline, I wanted to be a part of the women's Final Four. I believed I had earned an opportunity to be there, but Ann Myers was the analyst, and that wasn't changing at that point. And so I requested this opportunity, and ESPN said yes. So the first thing I did was call Al Troutwig and Michelle DeFoya and say, how the hell do I do this job? And so they both sort of said, well, you know, you've got to find every clip, every article. Here are the resources, you know, through which you come across all of those things. And get to know the players, talk to them, get to know their coaches, talk to them about the players. And you dig and you dig and you dig as a sideline reporter into anything that you as a fan consider interesting. And then you try to deliver that to the audience. You get them as close to these players in this game as we are lucky enough to be. So that's one way. And then, you know, analyst, I think the game changer for many analysts is synergy, the access we have to synergy. So I'm covering a Clippers game as an analyst, Richard, and I can go on synergy and I want to know, okay, in pick and roll situations, Chris Paul goes right 75% of the time. If he goes left, he's going to shoot the pull-up jump shot. If he goes right, he's more than likely going to go to the basket. Or, you know, there's just, I can basically click around the internet on this Synergy website and get anything I need to see. I can watch entire games. I can look at the last 25 baskets a player has made. It's a game changer in terms of time, right? We all need time in order to prepare. So there's a few things that are incredibly helpful, and those are two of those for me.
And that's Synergy Sports. Doris, in terms of the preparation for each of these, sideline reporting and being an analyst on an NBA game, is your access to the players and the coaches different depending on what your assignment is that day?
No question about it. You know, in a college game, I will travel in specifically early enough the day prior so that I can see the home team practice. And if you're fortunate enough, the away team will come in that night and at least get some shooting up so you might be able to interact with the kids in that sort of environment. And then game day, you go to both shoot-arounds. And generally speaking, and I'm trying to think if there's anyone who prohibits you, maybe on an occasion one coach might say, hey, we're going to close this practice for today. It could be they're in the midst of a difficult stretch or there's something specific they don't want you to know. But by and large, my ability to get to a college practice is very easy to do. And to me, that's helpful, right? Our job is to provide access. We, you know, if Roy Williams or Mike Krzyzewski say something that I think the viewer would find compelling in practice, it's my job to deliver it because I really believe the audience would rather hear those two Hall of Famers and their thoughts regarding their team than my thoughts. You know, don't get me wrong. It's my job to talk about the game and things I find interesting and any observation I have. But by and large, viewers are tuning in to see their teams, their rooting interest. And if the coach is saying something or the player has told us interesting, we try to make sure within the context of what we're doing, we deliver that. NBA, it's an entirely different thing. If ESPN goes into broadcast an NBA game, you know, depending again on schedules, because many times it might be a back-to-back, and so teams are flying in day of, and we wouldn't have access to these guys maybe until the evening. But ESPN, because we're a national broadcast partner, very much like TNT, we would say, okay, we're sitting with Cleveland. We'd like to talk to LeBron James, have a little, you know, sit down interview with him. We'll do it. You got to do it fast. You've got to be as efficient as possible. Mike Breen would generally be the guy asking the questions. Some of it's on camera. Then we might, you know, get some stuff off camera. And then that night at the arena, whether that happened after shoot around or perhaps, you know, 2 hours before tip. And then about an hour before every NBA game, the entire broadcast team goes in and meets with the head coach of these franchises. And, you know, just again, it's a brief opportunity to catch up with that coach. Where's your team? What do you think of the matchup? Why is this guy struggling? You know, what's made this guy successful? So it is definitely, you know, there are two distinct ways of doing things and they work, I think, equally well. Certainly there's times someone who enjoys basketball, I would love to be able to watch practice at the NBA prior to. You might get in the last 15 minutes, but they're shooting. So one of the things I've done the last couple of years is I'll go to an NBA camp, just ask, can I please come and just observe? So last year I went to the Clippers and to Cleveland and just try to get some sense, okay, how do these guys put their teams together? What are they teaching at the start of training camp? Things that might help me during the course of the year.
That's interesting. Should I not be surprised that, especially the Clippers, Doc Rivers seems to be a very media-friendly coach, so that would be allowed? The Cavs are more interesting to me.
Yeah, Doc had. And to be honest, if you see this, I've done it with the Celtics in the past. And actually, that was the first year I did it years ago when Doc was a coach. I thought, you know, I'm getting a little bit more analyst work. I really have a lot to learn. Let me see if Doc will let me into camp. And that was really sort of how that came about. And at Doc's camp last year, You had a Michigan State assistant. You had the entire LSU, or at least two representatives from the LSU men's basketball program at Clipper Camp. So, yeah, I'm definitely not the only one doing this, that's for sure.
Doris, this is sort of my anecdotal observation, but I wonder if you agree with me. When you are covering women's basketball as an analyst, my sense is that the access that you can get to players and coaches far supersedes when you have that assignment for the NBA and maybe even the WNBA. I wonder if I'm correct about that or if I'm sort of just overestimating my own access to people like Gino Auriemma, but I've always found that that sport is really a great sport for letting the media, for the most part, get whatever they need. And if you're a rights holder broadcaster like you are, I would think the sky would be the limit.
I would say, by and large, that is true of both men's and women's college basketball. There are certain programs who have certain reservations about things, but honest to goodness, most times I would say it's comparable. But yes, you know, I think the women understand the point in history within which they're operating, right? They're still trying to grow the sport. And so, sure, you know, this is one of the great things that we always appreciated about Pat Summitt and now appreciate about Gino Auriemma. You know, those were two coaches who were willing when our programming department, and I'll, you know, mention the great Carol Stiff because she just does such an extraordinary job of getting, you know, great. We're trying to get the best possible matchups for women's college basketball. You know, they'll play anyone, anywhere, anytime in an attempt to grow the game. And I think that's important. And, you know, most coaches will allow you all kinds of access into their locker room. They might allow you to ask, you know, sort of an end of quarter interview similar to what we get in the NBA. And it's important. And, you know, we appreciate it. I think it helps the fan, the viewer, enjoy the sport a little bit more.
Do you know exactly what your package will be of NBA games this year that you'll be an analyst on?
No, and that's not unusual for any of us at this point. I would say probably Mike Breen might be a guy who has to know his schedule because he's sort of juxtaposing it next to the New York Knicks schedule, and he's our lead analyst, and rightly so. But generally speaking, across the board, the NBA schedule unfolds slightly different than the college basketball schedule. You know, I don't know exactly what the timetable is, but we get it at a certain point, and then you plug it in. You know, I have a general idea of, you know, what we all cover for college basketball. Some of the women's games I will do, or at least in the next few weeks, we'll all have a pretty good handle. As you can imagine, there's not an announcer at ESPN who wouldn't like to be calling, who's involved with basketball in any level, who isn't dying to know what their schedule is right at this moment. You might have some general knowledge of what conference you'll be in and what day you might be working, but specifically, no, not, you know, it unfolds differently for each sport.
Are you expecting more than 20 NBA games that you'll be an analyst, or do you not even at this point know the number?
No, you know what, it's interesting. Early on, they just said to me, you know, how would you feel about, you know, the opportunity to call a regular NBA package? And I said, I've been at this a long time. I always tell young broadcasters, just put your head down, work as hard as you possibly can on whatever event is right in front of you and let the chips fall where they may. And so, I said I was thrilled. I was absolutely thrilled to be able to be a regular analyst on the NBA, and we'll see how that unfolds.
Doris, you do NBA games. Kara Lawson has done NBA games in terms mm-hmm. of the analyst position. Where do you, and I eventually want to ask you about social media, and that's not necessarily the best barometer of how fans feel, but do you feel there is still a stigma that exists when a woman is assigned to the analyst chair of an NBA game?
It's an interesting question. You know, I still think, and I think I saw Stephanie Drewley do a Q&A with you, and one of the things that I was very happy to see her say was she mentioned that social media, even though she believes I do a very credible job on the NBA games in which I'm assigned, she said, you still see some backlash on Twitter. She said, it's my job to ignore that. And that made me happy because you don't know how your bosses are reacting to what they might be seeing in social media. We live in an age where social media is increasingly important to all of us in the industry. You know, it's honestly, Twitter is an incredible news source for me. I can't tell you how thankful I am because via Twitter, I have read any number of articles, sports related or not, that somebody might have retweeted, which frankly, I would have never read had I not had access to that. So I love that piece of it. On the other hand, you know, there are a lot of people who object to me calling color on NBA games, and I certainly understand the reaction. I've never played, nor have I coached in the NBA. I still believe I do a very good job when I call those games, but I understand the objection, I guess. But it was great for me to read in print Stephanie's thought that it's my job to ignore that. And this is what I tell young broadcasters. Don't ever, ever read the positive press or the negative press or the positive reaction or the negative reaction. Don't waste energy on it because they're both sort of illusory. The reality is you will know the job that you're doing, the quality of the job you are doing based on the assignments your bosses are giving you. Ultimately, this is how I decide what kind of a job am I doing. What is an ESPN entrusting me to do? And as importantly to me, what am I feeling from the coaches and the players that I'm covering? Can I sense that they respect me, that they know that I'm going to do the best job I can to honor, you know, the game right in front of me, the players and the coaches and the stories that we're supposed to document for those who are tuning in? You know, like everybody can say, you know, ESPN's motto, serve the sports fan, is whatever you might want to call it. But that's the reality. That's our job. We're supposed to serve the sports fan. And it's so funny. Like, I remember when I was young and I had just started and I was worried because I thought, oh, my goodness, you know, I'm not as vivacious, as excitable, as lively as Dick Vitale. That's just not in my nature. Now, don't get me wrong, the game has literally been such a defining factor in my life since the time I was 7. But I was questioning. I was at Dave Gavitt's house for dinner, and I said, you know, he said, you know, are you enjoying it? I said, I really am. I think I can get better. But I'm concerned that I don't have a big enough personality for this. And he said to me, always remember, and you've heard it before, but it's true. Always remember, you know, the fan isn't tuning in to hear you. The fan is tuning in to watch the game. It's that simple. They either have a rooting interest or they're looking to take their mind off their life or whatever the reason may be. Believe me when I tell you, they're not tuning in because you're calling it. And I always sort of like, I laugh and I get a chuckle out of it, but it's true.
Doris, you mentioned Twitter, and this is an interesting subject with you, and I think you've been asked about it before, but I want to ask you about it now that you're on this podcast. You're one of the broadcasters where oftentimes if you do a game, you will trend on Twitter. There are certain broadcasters for both, I don't even think good and bad is the right phrase. For whatever reason, people take an interest when they are broadcasting. You, Joe Buck, Phil Simms, Chris Berman, Jim Nantz, et cetera, whoever they are. I've talked to many broadcasters on this podcast, and they have different approaches when it comes to social media. Some read their mentions. They want to know sort of what the pulse of things are being said. Others stay far away from it. I've had a lot of women on this podcast, women journalists, who have to deal with some of the worst stuff that you can imagine. And I remember Jemele Hill famously telling me on this podcast, there essentially is not a day that goes by where someone does not call her the N-word on Twitter. So that's a long preamble to, are you aware of, even after the fact, of what people are saying about you on Twitter, and does it have any impact on you? Do you want to know? Do you not want to know? How do you approach that?
Yes, I am aware. I mean, I'm not reading every one of your, and forgive me, I don't know the vernacular of Twitter because I don't tweet very often. I might retweet. Well, I'm getting a little bit better. If the mentions are where it's somebody's addressing you at and then your handle, you know, you get those notifications that pop up.
Right.
And so I'm not going to let them pile up ad nauseum. I'll click, you know, at whatever. Am I aware of it? Yeah, sometimes, you know, you've got somebody really coming at you. And I'm so sorry to hear that about Jemele. I mean, that's just wildly disturbing, but as somebody who has been the recipient of, obviously not that, because I'm not black, but who has certainly been on the receiving end of, you know, some ugliness, yes, I'm aware of it. I don't obsess about it. And again, I go back to the point I made earlier, whether it's a newspaper story that's complimentary or perhaps a newspaper story where a media critic has hit you a little bit, you know, obviously you take constructive criticism from people you trust. And I think every announcer, by and large, is pretty coachable. Many of us are former athletes, and so we're accustomed to being coached. I think it depends on where it's coming from. But I am aware, and, you know, I too watched the Sarah Spain video where, you know, they had those men off the street read some of the ugly comments.
Right.
It was an incredibly powerful thing to watch. I think people, you know, words are incredibly powerful. That's the reality. You can do a lot of good or a lot of damage with what you allow to come out of your mouth or with what you allow to be put into Twitter space. And so I think, you know, we just need to be mindful of that, if you're a fan or whatever. Because, listen, I'm human, Richard. Some of the things have absolutely hurt. It's not like can be in your – it hurts. Of course it hurts. All of us want to be considered, you know, good at our job. We want to be liked. That's the reality. But I also am very aware that you could be in a room, walk into the room, and have two opinions 180 degrees from each other and come to find out they're talking about the same announcer. It's just the way it is.
Doris, one of the things that you get a lot of credit for is having very pointed and direct questions for the NBA coaches that you interview at the end of quarters. How do you form your questions, and how often do you think about forming a question that can produce an answer, an interesting answer, a compelling answer, given you don't have a lot of time in those segments?
Well, first of all, you know, generally speaking, I'm working with great analysts, right? So if I'm with Mike, Jeff, and Mark, and play-by-play guys, you know, Mike has been around the NBA forever. And so I think, you know, he, because of the respect he's built and the equity he has in the league, there are times where and he doesn't do it often, but you might get a little bit of opinion from him, or he might be responding to something Mark or Jeff say. But very often, Richard, I am just listening to great analysts call a game. And so if Jeff or Mark say, well, geez, this guy's in, and that's out of their normal rotation, well, right away at my seat, I'm thinking, okay, well, how do I respectfully ask this coach, why are you playing that guy in this particular spot? And, you know, you have to be respectful. I try to be incredibly concise because these men are essentially interrupting their jobs to provide the fan, through us, access to some of the things going on. And, you know, it's funny, different coaches approach it different ways, and some are very nice and divulge nothing, and some are shorter and divulge nothing. So, yeah. You know, I'm paying very close attention to everything I'm watching, everything I'm hearing. And when the end of quarter approaches, I would say from about the 4 minute mark and down, you know, I might be taking notes. There was, you know, 15-2 run at this moment. Why did that happen? We do get some training at ESPN, obviously, on, you know, good question, bad question, how to formulate it. And listen, if the game dictates, and very often you'll see me do this in the NBA finals or down the stretch of a conference finals, I'm going to ask one question. Are we allowed to ask two? Yes, of course we are. But if a coach is down 15 and needs to get back to the huddle, I can promise you I'm asking him one coach out of respect to the job he's trying to do.
Doris, I want to reference the Rembrandt Brown interview that you did for New York Magazine because it was really, really interesting. And there were two things in here that really stood out to me that you and Rembrandt, a guest, by the way, on this podcast, talked about. One was on Greg Popovich, and you said something that really struck me. You said, I don't give him a pass anymore. It now frustrates me to the point where I want to say, I'm not giving you a pass because I've seen you when Jeff Van Gundy walks over there, and the interaction is totally different. It's not a lot of people who make public the notion that while the theater of Pop not answering questions can be amusing and funny, he knows full well that there's a job that a coach should be doing here with a rights holder. And that's to sort of, you know, answer the question to the best of his ability when a reporter asks him a question. Why did you give that answer to Rembert? It just struck me as something very interesting that many people don't say about Greg Popovich. Even those who have great admiration for Greg Popovich and his, you know, remarkable basketball career.
Right. And, you know, I'm going to, before I answer it, if you'll allow me to tell a story about Greg Popovich.
Sure.
And obviously we all know his history. You know, this is a man who graduated from the Air Force Academy, who served his country, who sets up his organization along with the great R.C. Buford and the terrific ownership in San Antonio in a way that you can't help but admire. It's unselfish. It's team first. It's represented the standard of excellence of countless years of 50 wins and multiple championships. Anyone who's won one NBA championships knows how hard doing that is. You know, ask the Golden State Warriors how hard it was to repeat. So everybody will remember San Antonio's heartbreak, the Ray Allen three. They lose that game. They lose the next game. So they're walking out of American Airlines Arena in Miami. And I am walking to try to find my crew. And I walk directly into the path of Greg Popovich. So imagine how Greg Popovich felt at that moment, Richard. They lose game six. They lose game seven. And now here comes Greg Popovich. And he's got his, you know, his suit draped over his shoulder. And I take a step back because I'm like, oh, my God, you know, I feel so bad. And he instead stops, grabs my shoulders, turns me to him, and says, now, Doris, what will you do now that the season is over? And I said, well, one thing of interest to you, Pop, will be I'm going to go to Napa soon. You know, I tape a video game out there, and while I'm out there, I'm gonna go to wine country. And he said, before you go, you need to contact my secretary, and I'm going to give you exactly where you should go and when. And do you know that within a week of that heartbreak that he had just suffered one, he took the time to, you know, just say, how you doing? What's up now for you? And I got an incredibly long email basically saying, go to this restaurant, go to this winery, think about this. You know, it's a great picnic spot over here. So that's the kind of man he is, okay? For, you know, just extraordinary respect. And Mike Breen says to me all the time, do you mind if I say how much respect Pop has for you, what his interactions are with you behind the scenes? Because I want people to know what he thinks of you beyond what they're saying in that brief clip. And I said, Mike, you know what? I trust your instincts. You do whatever it is you want to do in that case. And I you know what? Rembert just asked me about it. And I was just being honest. You know, like, I adore Pop. But do I agree with how he handles those interviews? No. And to be honest, I don't even have to interview him that often. As you know, my sideline exposure in the NBA is generally a couple of games at the start, and then I move to the analyst role. And it isn't, for the most part, maybe one or two in the regular season, but then I don't move back to sideline until the playoffs. But I do watch the TNT sideline reporters, and I do watch Lisa Salters, and at the time, Heather Cox, or J.A. Adonde, or Israel Gutierrez, stand in and try to ask those questions. And whether it's me or whether it's them, I just don't agree with it. And Pop always used to say to us, Richard, he'd say, well, I'm sorry, but I get in there and I'm just locked in and I want to get to my job. But if it's been an NBA coach or an NBA player, he is different. And I don't pretend to know as much basketball as Greg Popovich. I'm not, you know, that old expression about he's forgotten more than I'll ever know. Of course. But, you know, I don't think it's asking too much for a league that has experienced great success, in part because of television coverage, who has seen its salaries grow to astronomical rates. I don't think it's a lot to stand in, whether you think the questions are inane, frustrating, aggravating. I think my questions are usually pretty solid. Hopefully that doesn't sound arrogant, but I think they're pretty solid. I don't think it's too much to stand in and deliver. And an interesting antidote was Steve Kerr. I was working a playoff game. I'd done San Antonio the night before and then had Steve's team. And Steve said, you know, kind of flippantly as he's walking by me, I see you survive, Pop. And I said, I'm all set with that. And he said, you know, what? And I kind of said, well, here are all my objections to it. And he said, well, know, I think you should say that to Pop. I said, sure, maybe if you give me 3 bourbons before I talk to him, I might be able to get that out of my mouth. So I don't know if that answers your question, but I adore the man. I just don't agree with how he handles the media sometimes.
I appreciate that. I think that's an honest and by the way, a correct answer as well. I want to, for one more thing in the Rembrandt interview, I want to ask you about, because we're talking about interviewing people on the sidelines. I've always found LeBron James, Doris, whether you interview him or whether any other sideline reporter interviews him, to be unbelievably great. He's been the face of the league forever. Maybe Steph Curry is now, or they're tied, whatever. But LeBron has, to me, always really stepped up in that position, understanding that when you sort of have the Jordan role, you have to answer these questions after games, both wins and sometimes losses. And many times I feel with you and with other reporters, he's not just good, he's great and really gives interesting, insightful answers. What has been your interaction and interpretation when you have interviewed LeBron in the game situation?
No, exactly your observations that LeBron, you know, he's one of the most observant people I've ever been around. He's watching everything, and it's fascinating because we have, to me, the brilliance of television are the extraordinary cameramen that capture the images that you always remember in your sports viewing history, right? Like, the cameramen are brilliant. And there's so many people contributing to a great telecast. And as much as we try to capture every single thing and bring it to the viewer, you can't. And so, you know, my eyes always gravitate to LeBron. What's he watching? What's he doing? Who's he communicating with? How's he doing it? And he's one of the most observant, intelligent people I've been around. And I think what he does, and it's funny, I did a media training with Providence College men's basketball at some point this summer, maybe about 6 weeks ago, and I had some clips of LeBron. And he's just very honest. He takes a moment to process it. He doesn't feel like he has to rush. And he actually gives thought, and then he responds. And at this point in his career, he's so secure in himself that he is very honest. And I don't think we can ask for much more. Do they think about the question? Do they give an honest response? It's our responsibility to come up with a decent question. And you hope for someone like LeBron, who's listening carefully and who doesn't mind answering honestly.
Doris, the other thing from the Rembrandt interview that I wanted to follow up with you on, which was really interesting, was you talked to Rembrandt and you said that there was a time where you sort of were bemoaning your fate, saying you should be an analyst on higher level games. You don't know why you're not. And one of your colleagues basically sort of gave you at least from his perspective, a real answer. And the answer was that he said, let your hair down, soften your look. I know it goes against every fiber of your being to be evaluated for anything other than what you're saying as an analyst, but it's a visual medium. And then you said, and this is a really, this stayed with me from that interview, and whether it was a coincidence or not, once I had done that, the level of games I was being assigned changed. That sentence and that story to me says so much about the business that you're in, that I'm tangentially in. And I wanted to just follow up with you on that because you followed that person's advice. Things did change. I'm not saying that is that's sort of the cause or the correlation, but have you ever sort of stepped back and realized that for everything one can do in the business, in the end, at least for some executives, it will always come down to it's a visual game. And
it's
not
a visual medium for women, not for men. Listen,
correct.
We still operate at a point in our history where women make 78 cents on the dollar. We still operate at a point in our history where women are evaluated differently, particularly in the sports landscape, than men, right? I mean, Brent Musburger and Dick Vitale remain brilliant broadcasters. But I don't know many women in their respective positions. In fact, play-by-play, it's sort of hard to make that comparison because you're just now seeing someone like Beth Mullins advance to a place where hopefully her career can take her, if she so chooses to stay in the business that long, to that age, correct? But I'm 50 years old, you know, unless things change, and they are changing, and I have to say I am incredibly proud of ESPN because it is a company, John Skipper, Stephanie Drewley, our leadership is now willing to put qualified women in, as you say, positions that are somewhat non-traditional. But that's a true story. And I'll tell you the producer, because he's a personal friend of mine. I've worked with this man for 30 years now. His name is Kim Belton, you know, former Stanford basketball player, just inducted into the Pac-12 Hall of Fame. He's been at ESPN or ABC for over 30 years. And I don't remember exactly when this would have been. I would have been calling some Big East men, but on ESPN Regional. I might have still been doing some Atlantic 10 men. But in terms of, at that point, breaking into, I was getting some ESPN, you know, sort of the mothership, as we like to call it, getting some men's games. And I just felt like, listen, we all look at our talents and believe we should have X job or Y job, and you're working as hard as you can, and you're putting your head down and doing the absolute best job you could. And I thought I should be on a higher level game. And Kim Belton, who I believe is one of ESPN's most talented and creative people, and who, by the way, for very long stretches of his career, was probably the only Black producer at ESPN. I mean, we're going to call the facts the facts.
Right.
So I'm sure he had navigated through some things. And he just said, do you want an honest answer? And I'm like, you know me. Of course I want an honest answer. And it's true, Richard. I mean, at the time, I was in a blue blazer. And, you know, I was thinking, well, the man next to me is in a blue blazer, and he's projecting this air of authority, and I'm in a role that women at that point were not doing a lot of, and thank God, you know, Jessica Mendoza, Kara Lawson, these women who are absolutely fabulous at what they do, are starting to make the progress they should, and this guy just laid it out there, and I said, I have a choice to make, and at that point, I think I felt comfortable enough with my abilities as an analyst to go ahead and say, okay, you know what, take a deep breath. It's no different than for a very long time. It took me time to relax and laugh and have fun because I felt like I was always proving myself as an analyst because most of my work was as men's college basketball. And I was with my son one night and we're watching a game and the announcers are clearly enjoying one another and the game. And my son just looks at me and says, Mom, what you fail to realize is when you're having a good time on the air, so are we. Because by those two announcers enjoying each other and enjoying the game, it helped us enjoy. And Dick Vitale had said this to me for years. People aren't tuning in to hear. Listen, this is what makes Jeff Van Gundy to me the best analyst. In the business, you know, Jeff, when he has to deliver the basketball goods, delivers it and delivers it in a way, you know, that's truly extraordinary. That's what the best guys do. The Jeffs, the Marks, the Chris Collinsworth, but they also understand that the viewer doesn't want to know how smart you are about the game. They want to enjoy it. They want to enjoy it. Don't be preaching at, you know, they don't want to be preached at, or they don't want you to tell you how smart they are. They want to enjoy the game.
Doris, one follow-up on this, and I agree with you. I think that by far and away the best sports network when it comes to this stuff has been ESPN. They put women in untraditional positions on air, which I think is great. I think they've actually lived up to what they've tried to do in terms of diversifying the front-facing talent. So here's my question to you, Dars. I see people like Jessica Mendoza getting opportunity. I think that's great. I see you and Kara Lawson doing NBA games. One, it's certainly based on merit, and two, I think it's good. But yet, I look across the business. I still see a ton of young women, generally speaking, in sideline positions, and I see people like Pam Oliver being pushed out for someone younger, although in Pam's case, they did eventually bring her back and put her on a smaller team. So what am I to believe, Dars? Am I to believe that the business is changing and that we will see 50, 55, 60-year-old women on television like we do with men? Or are people like you and Kara and Jessica Mendoza and Beth Mowins merely outliers and nothing's really changed from the 60s?
Well, I think like most societal changes, and I do believe it has to be at that fundamental core level, right? There has to be fundamental societal change. And the way that happens is in little pockets and corners, whether we're talking about a corporate environment, you know, a sports media environment, you know, wherever it is, you know, there has to be a fundamental cultural shift in what we believe women are capable of. You know, if Hillary Clinton gets elected, it will be because she is amongst the most qualified candidates ever. I know the objections about the history and all of those things aside, but in just in terms of Hillary Clinton's political experience, I'm not endorsing one candidate or the other. You know, I'm not supposed to do that. But what I'm saying is, when she gets elected, or if she gets elected, can we please just discuss whatever decisions she makes in the office, regardless of her gender? Right? Are we there yet? Of course we're not there yet. Are there going to be men out there who won't vote for Hillary because they say, well, she can't be the commander-in-chief? Yes. You know what? I think that will happen. Just like there's going to be a viewer who tunes in, listens to me. It's going to be jarring. They're going to say she's never coached or played in the NBA. She doesn't belong there. I can't change that. I go back to the discussion we had earlier. It will take intrepid individuals in positions of power to help make fundamental change. That's the truth. So we're making progress.
All right, we'll finish up with a couple of fun ones. We talked about Popovich. Who's the easiest coach in the NBA to interview and why?
Probably Doc Rivers, because he's not opposed to having some fun. You know, his son had that one little great stretch in a game, came off the bench, you know, had just this extraordinary 4 or 5 minute rip right at the end of the quarter. And I was sitting there saying, you know, can I ask the father-son question? I'm going back and forth with Eddie Fibishaw, who's producing the game. And I'm saying, Eddie, I want to ask, what do you think? Is it appropriate? Should I do it? How do I do it? That sort of thing. And we're going back and forth. And he's trying to produce the game. But Eddie Fibishaw, you know, to his great credit, and I appreciated it because I'm bouncing it back and forth with him. He said, you got to ask it. You got to ask it. And so I did. And Doc didn't mind. You know, he addressed it because he watched it. And he addressed it as the dad he was for that particular moment. So I love interviewing Doc. He's nice and easy.
Dars, who are some NBA players who you think could make a fairly seamless transition from playing to broadcasting?
That's a great question. You know what? I haven't thought of it, and I wonder why more don't. You know, to be honest with you, I think one of the guys at our network who has got an incredibly high ceiling, who I think will just grow and grow and grow, is Chauncey Billups. I just, you know, I think he's figuring out the job, and he's finding his voice, and there isn't anything in the NBA he doesn't know or, you know, couldn't watch and decipher. I haven't really thought about that one. I don't think LeBron would do it. I think his interests preside elsewhere. You know, as interesting a question is, with increasingly there to be a desire for strong opinion expressed in various roles in television, what NBA player would not object to critiquing or voicing what could be considered harsh or negative opinion about, you know, the NBA fraternity? That's not an easy thing to do.
Yeah, it's true. I think Kobe actually would be great. I don't think he'll do it, but he would be a very...
Right, exactly right, because Kobe wouldn't care. You know, Kobe as a teammate would hold
exactly
you to a standard.
Right. All right, off the top of your head, Dars, I won't hold this to you. This is an invisible ink. It's not in permanent ink. Is Connecticut going to repeat this year for women's basketball?
No.
No? Okay, I like that. I agree with you. You have a team that you like more? I like Notre Dame this year, personally.
I love Notre Dame. I love Baylor. I love Texas, South Carolina. Ohio State, I'm really fascinated, you know, to see what kind of progress Ohio State can make. So, yeah, you know, I thought it was really cool, Richard, that Washington and Syracuse made the run. As you know, no national champion in women's basketball has come ever from outside the top 10. And so, you know, we need to start having that wealth spread downward.
Final question, Dars. I'm asking you to put your Providence College assistant coaching or head coaching hat on if you want the bump. NBA endgame situation. Tell me what play you'd be running for what player and why that would be your most favorable endgame option in the NBA. Your team's down one. You can have any players in the NBA. What are you calling in an endgame situation with, let's say, 7 seconds left on the clock?
Well, the easy answer is, you know, you see so often these guys go to some sort of pick and roll option. I probably would go to some sort of like pinch post, pin down play for LeBron James and try to get him in space because I always think he makes the best decisions with the ball in his hands.
I like that. Right.
How could I go away from LeBron James?
All right. Would Steph be your second option, or would there be a surprise second option?
Oh boy! You know who really fascinates me as an NBA player is Klay Thompson.
Yeah.
He really does, because you saw Steph in some people's minds come out of nowhere as this guy with an ability to dominate the game. We've seen Klay Thompson dominate the game in pockets. But I believe there's another level. Like he's capable of dominating games for more consistent stretches. Now, will that be possible because of the style of play that they have and the addition of Kevin Durant? I don't know. You know, that's obviously, you know, the lead storyline going into the season is a team off a record-setting number of wins, and you add one of the great players in the NBA, but I don't think it's as easy as people think it will be simply because you add Kevin Durant. You lost great rim protection, and, you know, you give up something when you get a player of Kevin Durant's caliber. There's a lot of storylines in the NBA. I'm curious to see, you know, under the direction of Tom Thibodeau, does Minnesota take a big step forward? A near universal opinion expressed to me is the job Brad Stevens has done with the Boston Celtics, so I think there's a lot going on. It's funny, I had a member of ESPN's leadership team say to me, you know, we have a league that's at, you know, extraordinary levels of popularity with superstars who are, for the most part, by and large, very likable with very compelling personal stories. You know, it's really cool that we get to be a part of it. And, I couldn't agree more.
All right, Darce, you've given us an hour. So we're going to let you go. The guest has been
That went fast, right?
The guest has been Darce Burke. She, of course, is an analyst on ESPN's NBA coverage. She's an analyst on ESPN's women's basketball coverage. She does sideline reporting for the NBA. I believe she calls Monday Night Football and MLS games as well for ESPN. Am I right about that, Darce? Or maybe I'm
no
my mistake.
MLS Monday Night Football. No.
All right. Yeah. I'm just trying to bump your resume.
I'd more importantly want you to pump up my salary if that were the case.
unfortunately, Darce, I would say talk to your agents on that instead of me. But I'll put a good word in next time I see John.
Thanks for having me, Richard. Seriously.
Yeah, no, Darce. You know, we've known each other a while, and you know, I have great respect for your work. And when good people and people who really, really put the time in and grind get good positions, I think we're all in the business better for that. So I appreciate you joining us on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast, and in all seriousness, continued best with your career.
Thank you so much.
All right, back in the studio to wrap up. My thanks to Darce Burke, who was really, really terrific. Gave you really some interesting insights, I thought, into the business, how she approaches her craft, interviewing Greg Popovich. She even gave you basically what she would call, as a former Providence coach, late game situation in the NBA. She likes LeBron, clear out, and let him make his decision. You probably win a lot of games that way. My thanks to our sponsors, Harry's. Please support them the way they support this podcast, and we appreciate them very much. Remember to listen and subscribe to new and archived episodes of the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast with Richard Deitch, wherever you listen to podcasts, including SI.com, iTunes, Spotify, and others. Thank you again for supporting the podcast. Thanks to everybody who helped out. This is Richard Deitch. We'll see you again on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast.
This has been a digital media production. Find your voice.
Do you know about the Locked On Podcast Network? The number one daily sports podcast network. Locked On has a daily podcast on every NBA and NFL team, plus a growing lineup of college and MLB teams. You get a daily bite-sized podcast giving you the latest on your team from the local experts. Lakers fans, search Locked On Lakers. Cowboys fans, search Locked On Cowboys. Just search Locked On, your favorite team, on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts, or tell your smart speaker to play podcast Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.